And you're listening to special coverage on 89.3 KPCC. A very good morning to you. I'm Larry Mantle, and this is Air Talk as we follow NPR special coverage. As you just heard, the House of Representatives voting along generally party lines voted to send the two articles of impeachment against President Trump to the Senate. They'll do that actual formal walkover of the articles of impeachment to the Senate a little bit later this afternoon. In the meantime, let's review what happened this morning, as there were certainly pointed speeches given by members of both parties in the debate prefacing the House vote. Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler reiterated the necessity for a trial, saying the president betrayed our country.
He jeopardized our national security. He did all this for his personal political gain. And then he violated the Constitution by stonewalling Congress's efforts to investigate, ordering an absolute blockade of evidence. Despite that, the House was able to uncover powerful evidence that demonstrates beyond doubt the president's betrayal and violations of the Constitution. But we still have not heard the whole truth, because the president has refused to allow a single document to be turned over to the House in response to our impeachment subpoenas, and he has prevented us from hearing key witnesses as well. This is unprecedented.
Representative Doug Collins, the Republican of Georgia, said Democrats were out to get President Trump from right after his election.
You see, the Speaker, and what I've heard today, even from folks giving 1 minute, Madam Speaker, is that this is all they wanted. It was a political impeachment. They have said he is impeached for life. This shows the true motivation, I believe, of the other side. It is their dislike for this president and the good work he is doing. So, Madam Speaker, before I reserve here for a moment, this has always been a political impeachment. Even today on the floor, the talk of the president being forever impeached and it's always being sustained forgets the Senate trial. I hope this ends this political impeachment and this body never sees it again.
Earlier this morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced the 7 members of Congress who will serve as impeachment managers. She summarized each of their backgrounds and explained the reasoning behind her choices.
The emphasis is on litigators. The emphasis is on comfort level in the courtroom. The emphasis is making the strongest possible case to protect and defend our Constitution, to seek the truth for the American people.
So 7 members of Congress chosen to be the prosecutors in the Senate trial, to be led by Los Angeles area member of Congress, chairman of the Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff. The others, Jerry Nadler, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, from whom you just heard, as well as a representative group, 5 others with racial and gender diversity. They include Sylvia Garcia of Texas, Hakeem Jeffries of New York, Val Demings of Florida, Jason Crow of Colorado, and Northern California Congressmember Zoe Lofgren. With us to talk about where things stand now as we head to the U.S. Senate for the trial is Professor Jens David Olien, Cornell University. He's also Vice Dean of Cornell's School of Law. Professor, it's good to have you with us again on Air Talk. Let's talk about the process here in the Senate now. You think it's likely that we are going to see witnesses called to testify?
It's undecided right now because I think the current situation is both sides have agreed that they'll start the trial without resolving the question of witnesses, and then presumably halfway through the trial there'll be a discussion of whether or not witnesses should be called. And I think all eyes are going to be on the few Republican senators like Murkowski, Collins, Romney, who might be willing to side with the Democrats. But up until now, they haven't said anything definitive about being willing to support witnesses. So I think they're waiting to see what happens with the beginning of the trial and if there's some kind of compelling case that can be made that witnesses need to be called.
And do you think that it is important for witnesses to be called, or is the record sufficient from the House impeachment that prosecutors as well as the defense team from the president can argue based on what's there as well as the documents that Democrats released yesterday?
Well, it is true there is a very well-developed record because the fact-finding in the House was rather extensive On the other hand, Trump directed some of his aides not to comply with the House subpoenas, and the House committees didn't hear from a few of the key players, like Bolton, like Mulvaney, other people who were directly involved in the withholding of aid to Ukraine, and their testimony was never delivered to the House. So I think, you know, precisely because Trump directed them not to comply with subpoenas and directed them not to cooperate with the House investigation, there's a compelling case that their testimony needs to be entered into the record at some point and in some way. And given that this is the end of the process, the trial in the Senate, we should hear from them now. And I think that's a fairly compelling case.
We're talking with Cornell University Vice Dean of the School of Law and Law Professor Jens David Olien. Also with us from the University of Missouri, Professor of Law Frank O. Bowman III, visiting scholar at Georgetown Law School as well, and author of the recently published High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump. Professor Bowman, pleasure to have you with us today. Do you think it's essential that witnesses be called or that the Senate should feel legally compelled to have witnesses?
Well, as was just said, I think the case developed in the House already is quite strong. And frankly, there's more than sufficient evidence to conclude that Mr. Trump did what he is charged with doing, that is to say, abuse the power of his office, and to conclude that that represents an impeachable and convictable high crime and misdemeanor. But here's where the witnesses assume some importance. One of the principal defenses by the president and his supporters during the House process was that there was no direct proof that he had actually given the orders to cause aid to be withheld to Ukraine in return for announcement of an investigation. Now, frankly, that's unnecessary as a logical matter. There's really no other logical explanation for what happened, and there's plenty of testimony from which we can, infer beyond any reasonable doubt that that's what happened. But the president's saying there's no direct proof, and therefore you can't convict me. And that song is also being sung by his supporters. So if that's the nature of the defense, you don't have direct proof. The direct proof would come from precisely the people whom Trump has ordered not to appear. You have the president on the one hand saying you can't convict me because you don't have direct proof, but I'm going to prevent you from getting the direct proof that would be necessary according to my own theory of the case. So to fill in that gap, if we can call it, yes, I think it would be entirely appropriate for witnesses to be called. Moreover, there's a point of constitutional principle here. The president simply has no right to refuse himself to provide evidence to an impeachment inquiry or to an impeachment trial. He certainly has no right to command his subordinates to refuse to appear in front of the Senate for an impeachment trial. If Congress, both the House and the Senate, in effect, acquiesce in this defiance of legitimate congressional authority, then we have a real separation of powers crisis, a real crisis of constitutional proportion.
Why wouldn't the president have the right to invoke executive privilege and to refuse to provide documents or to try and block witnesses from testifying as part of the separation of powers? And then it's up to the court system to determine whether the president is compelled to cooperate or not?
Well, first of all, because I think it's fairly clear to me that executive privilege simply has no place in an impeachment proceeding. The executive privilege is a court-created doctrine that does give some sphere of privacy for advice to a president from his most intimate advisors. But that certainly does not extend. First of all, even in cases where it applies, it is limited. It's not absolute. Courts have said over and over and over again that claims of executive privilege have to yield to showings of need. That was precisely what happened in the Nixon case when the Supreme Court told President Nixon he had to turn over the tapes. And that wasn't even in a case where the House was exercising its constitutionally granted and exclusive power to impeach the president and the Senate to try him.
But I guess my point is it was a court that decided that the president just didn't, on his own, roll over. It went to a court, said, no, you can't withhold this.
But in the Nixon case, the subpoenas that were at issue were actually grand jury subpoenas. The trial that or not grand jury subpoenas, actually they were trial subpoenas. It was in a criminal case in the courts when that was litigated. In a situation like the present one, the president can assert executive privilege if he wants to, but you notice he hasn't done that. He's not asserted any kind of privilege either in court or in Congress. He simply said, "I'm not going to send him. You can't come." And in any case, if he were to assert executive privilege, it's my view, in the Senate, it's my view that the Senate is the appropriate body to determine that. It's their job to determine what evidence is available and should be produced from the president. It's not the president's job to try to limit that evidence.
We'll continue our conversation with University of Missouri law professor Franco Bowman III. Also with us, professor from Cornell University, where he's vice dean of law, Jens David Olien. We're talking about the vote taken just minutes ago by the House of Representatives to send the two articles of impeachment to the U.S. Senate. They'll physically be delivered in just a few hours. And of course, NPR providing its live coverage throughout the afternoon here on 89.3 KPCC. Back in just 1 minute. Los Angeles area Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff, a frequent guest with us on Air Talk for many, many years, is going to be the leader of the prosecution effort against President Trump in the U.S. Senate when its trial begins. That's anticipated to be as soon as Tuesday of next week, the day after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We'll, of course, be bringing you gavel-to-gavel coverage right here on 89.3 KPCC. We look forward to having the congressman on the program soon to talk about a very important role that he's taking on as one of the seven prosecutors of the Democratic majority case from the House against the president in the U.S. Senate, where, of course, there's a Republican majority. Question whether witnesses will be called. We also have Democrats releasing a series of documents yesterday, including new information in documents obtained from Lev Parnas, who is a close associate of Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's personal lawyer. There's a handwritten note mentioning asking Ukraine's president to investigate, quote, the Biden case. Also, the documents show Lev Parnas communicating with Rudy Giuliani before the removal of the ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. A man named Robert F. Hyde disparaged Yovanovitch in messages to Parnas and gave him updates on her location and the use of her cell phone. This raises questions as to whether private citizens were surveilling Marie Yovanovitch during the time that she was U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Parnas was in frequent communication with Rudy Giuliani and with Ukrainian officials, according to the messages. Rudy Giuliani, there's also documentation of his efforts to try and have a personal meeting with Vladimir Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, and it appears the president of Ukraine stonewalled and did not take that meeting with Rudy Giuliani. I want to ask our legal experts about the significance of this. Dean Jens David Olien, is this something that has to be dealt with in the course of a Senate trial, including the calling of witnesses to give first-person accounts?
I think the Democrats will definitely want to explore some of this information because it's obviously came too late to be included in the House report and in the House proceedings. And it's certainly relevant to the articles of impeachment because, as you'll recall, the key article of impeachment here is Trump's withholding of the aid to Ukraine in an attempt to secure an announcement regarding an investigation into Biden. And the entire Ukraine strategy was not something that was being pursued through official channels entirely. It was also being pursued by Giuliani, and the recent documents from Parnas fill out an account, which I think is basically an almost shadow State Department effort, a kind of parallel track being run by Giuliani and a few other people to implement Trump's political desires with regard to Ukraine. And a lot of these documents include some disturbing details. So I suspect the Democrats will certainly try to introduce a discussion of these documents and refer to them. There might be an objection from some Republicans that this is new information that was not brought up in the House proceeding, and we'll just have to see how that unfolds in the trial.
Professor Olien, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Frank O'Bowman III, University of Missouri. Same question for you, the significance of these documents just released.
Well, I don't know enough about the details or, frankly, you know, of the documents themselves or how they dovetail into the rest of the case, although they seem basically supportive of the narrative that we already know regarding Trump's back channel efforts to essentially extort Ukraine. The larger point, I think, is the notion that somehow or other it would be illegitimate for the House managers or anybody else to introduce evidence in the Senate trial that was not part of the record at the time that the House voted articles of impeachment. That's actually just nuts. That's a principle that the Republicans have been brooding about, but they just made it up. It would be like saying that in a criminal case that the prosecution couldn't introduce any evidence in a criminal trial because he hadn't presented it in the grand jury, or that in a civil lawsuit you couldn't introduce any evidence at the civil trial that you actually didn't have at the time you filed a complaint. Well, that's not the way the law works in any other field. It's not the way impeachment works here, and there's certainly no precedent for this notion. For example, in the Andrew Johnson trial in 1868, some 30 or 40 witnesses were called, and certainly the evidence that they had and presented to the Senate was not had not been made available to the House.
All right.
Articles of impeachment.
I thank you very much, Professor Bowman, for being with us. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We have more political conversation that's coming up next hour. I'll tell you about that shortly. And special guest, LAPD Chief Michael Moore, with us too. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We're on for this full hour after last hour's NPR live coverage of the historic vote by the House of Representatives, 228-193, to send the two articles of impeachment to the U.S. Senate, where a trial is expected to begin on Tuesday. We'll have continuing coverage from NPR throughout the course of this afternoon, as there'll be a physical delivery of the two articles of impeachment to the U.S. Senate. But we turn our attention in this hour to another political story. Last night's final debate between Democratic candidates before the first of the caucuses and primaries. It was fittingly held at Drake University in Iowa, where the caucuses in Iowa start things off, and then we move to the New Hampshire primary from there. At the CNN Des Moines Register debate, there was a great deal of anticipation over how Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders would deal with Warren's allegation that Sanders had said to her that a woman couldn't win the presidential election, and he denied it.
Anybody knows me knows that it's incomprehensible that I would think that a woman could not be president of the United States. Go to YouTube today. There's a video of me 30 years ago talking about how a woman could become president of the United States.
Senator Warren pivoted when asked to respond to Bernie Sanders.
I think the best way to talk about who can win is by looking at people's winning record. So, can a woman beat Donald Trump? Look at the men on this stage. Collectively, they have lost 10 elections. The only people on this stage who have won every single election that they've been in are the women.
Sanders, along with Joe Biden, they had an exchange about foreign policy. This is one of the most direct exchanges between the two of them, in which Sanders criticized Biden's 2002 vote authorizing use of force in Iraq.
Joe and I listened to what Dick Cheney and George Bush and Rumsfeld had to say. I thought they were lying. I didn't believe them for a moment. I took to the floor. I did everything I could to prevent that war. Joe saw it differently.
Vice President Biden.
I was asked to bring 156,000 troops home from that war, which I did. I led that effort. It was a mistake to trust that they weren't going to go to war. They said they were not going to go to war. They said they were just going to get inspectors in. The world, in fact, voted to send inspectors in, and they still went to war. From that point on, I was in the position of making the case that it was a big, big mistake. And from that point on, I moved to bring those troops home.
I reprise the question that I often ask AirTalk listeners after a debate with the significance of this one, final one before the start of the caucuses and primaries. If you're someone who was not fully formed on who you wanted to vote for, you were still making up your mind, and last night helped solidify you toward one of the candidates, or maybe even go so far as to switch off of your favorite to another candidate after last night, I'd like to hear why. What it was that was said or communicated that somehow affected you to the extent it helped solidify how you think you're going to vote in the California primary, or caused you to switch from one Democrat to another. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. With me is the president of Way to Win, a national donor and organizer network working for progressive causes, Tori Gavito. Tori, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. It's nice to have six candidates and have a little bit more of a substantive exchange on the issues with the smaller field on stage. What impressed you most about what was revealed over the course of the 2+ hours?
I think we got to keep our eye on three things. First, I agree 100%. It was fantastic having a smaller stage. We could get into more substance on the issues. However, the fact that that stage was all white is troublesome. And so that's number one we have to keep our eye on. How do we continue? How do Democrats continue to really build off a diverse set of electorate to make sure that they're inspired to vote when the candidacy now is all white? The second thing is, you know, but the fact that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren were really the two top time getters in terms of how much time was spent on the issues that they're both proposing, really means that there is now these progressive policies are palatable in Iowa. I think that's a good thing for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party that has been pushing for major reform. I think the third thing that broke through absolutely impressed me was Elizabeth Warren putting to the end this question of electability and being a woman. The fact that women have really been leading the blue wave since 2017, flipping Alabama, you know, taking on the midterms, the largest swing in the House since 1974 in 2018. In 2019, we've continued to see wins. We're tracking wins at Way to Win. We've seen at least 50 wins in battleground states in 2019 in local elections, like Regina Romero in Tucson, Arizona, the first Latina to govern Tucson. These are women propelling these victories, and so absolutely women are electable.
Well, I wonder your thoughts between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Do you think that it would be higher odds of him beating President Trump because of his gender, or higher odds for Elizabeth Warren being a woman in beating Trump? How does the gender, if you look at the similarity of their policies, does gender play a role at all in the ability of those candidates to compete against President Trump?
Elections are all about addition. This is not geometry. This is not three-dimensional chess. This is addition, one voter at a time. Right now, according to Civics, yes, Republicans are underwater. They have about a 56% unfavorable rating nationally. But Democrats are also at about 50% unfavorable. And so we've got to think about, as Democrats have to think about, who are they putting on the top of that ticket that can both appeal to the 1.5 million folks that flipped from Obama to Trump in the Midwest and build a coalition to win that is part of the future coalition of winning, that is the 100 times that 1.5 million voters. You've got 100 times that amount of folks who are eligible to vote who didn't vote in 2016. Among those voters who sat home after voting for Obama but sat home in 2016, a good 70% of them are women, and the majority are people of color. And so
Does that give Warren an advantage if she were the nominee?
Yeah, it gives Warren an advantage. I think she can build a big coalition. And certainly gender gives her a boost. And in this instance, I don't actually think it is a deterrent. Now, that said, what is a deterrent is the Democrats continuing to fall for the trap of he said, she said, or this versus that. I mean, we know that cable news thrives on controversy. Coalitions do not thrive on controversy.
Why do you think that Warren raised this? Because I think there was a lot of, and she already had the problem with her Native American heritage, and you know that did some damage to her reputationally. Then she comes out and says that Bernie Sanders said a woman couldn't win the presidency, which I think raised a lot of skeptical response that he would say that. So what was the reasoning, do you think, for her making that claim?
Well, I can't. I'm not a psychologist, and I'm not in her campaign. I can tell you I don't think it was Elizabeth Warren's team that was raising it last night at the debate as much as the cable news that moderated.
Why wouldn't they raise it? If she raises something that's a serious charge, that if he really said, I mean, that would be such a foolish comment for him to make. If he really said that, she should publicize something that foolish.
Since 2016, Democrats have been questioning everything down to their shoelace color they were wearing that night on election night. So I think that a lot of Democrats are questioning what is viable, who is electable, what this country is ready for. And I think that it wouldn't be a shock if Bernie indeed said that. I've heard that question about women being electable. Is the United States ready for a woman president? I've heard that question behind closed doors. And so if it was levied, then certainly, and he's not the only one raising it, Kamala, Amy, Kirsten, you know, a number of women have been asked whether or not they're electable. And so having Elizabeth Warren bring up the question head on and tackling it, showing that women, in fact, are winning elections, I think it's smart to just push it aside and put the debate to rest.
Yeah, well, we'll see if that happens. I could certainly see him, if this was his view, saying, Elizabeth, I think I have a better chance of winning, and I think gender is a factor. It's another whole thing to say a woman can't win the presidency. But let's move on and talk about other issues that were raised. There was much about U.S. foreign policy and particularly American use of force in the wake of President Trump's order, the targeted killing of Iran's top general, and concerns about the U.S. moving into an armed conflict with Iran. Did you think that the candidates did a good job of drawing those distinctions? And do you think it potentially moved the needle among Democrats?
You know, President Trump brought this country to the brink of war with a foreign power that is a nuclear threat. This is something that none of us should take cavalierly. And I circle back to one of my original concerns about last night, that it is an all-white field of candidates right now. And when we talk about the military and military families, we have to recognize that it is incredibly racially diverse group of people. People of color make up 40% of active duty military in the Defense Department right now, up 25% from 1990. That drive is primarily led by Latino and Black people serving in the military. We have to take every life seriously, and all Americans' lives are on the line. And so to have candidates up there that reflect these communities, I think, is going to be incredibly important as we move forward. And it's something Democrats are going to have to think of now that the field is so white, to make sure that the vice president choices is really reflective of these growing concerns. I think it was right for Democrats to start on the Iran question last night, and I think it's right for Democrats to take these world affairs seriously moving forward.
We're talking with Tory Gavito, president of Way to Win, national donor and organizer network that works for progressive causes. We're talking about last night's candidates debate. Amy Klobuchar has been one of the strongest debaters. That's certainly my view. I think there are many other people who've seen her as one of the strongest debaters throughout the course of this. Nonetheless, she's sort of hanging around on the perimeter when it comes to polling. Is there anything in the Iowa caucus system that might give her a chance to overperform versus the polls and to make enough strong enough showing to really enhance her fundraising and to further raise her profile?
What I understand about Amy Klobuchar, particularly from operatives in Minnesota, is that she is a top-notch retail politician. She gets out there, she knocks doors. The primary in Iowa is very much a door-to-door, person-to-person persuasion campaign. And so in that sense, Amy Klobuchar's tenacity and her background in Minnesota make her ideal. You know, at the same time, it is a moment where the Democratic electorate realizes they're on the Titanic and they're looking for the folks with the lifeboats. And it's not going to be enough to have middle of the road policies that kind of take things back to status quo before Trump. We need broad reform to make sure that this country's top issues, from healthcare to climate change to wealth inequality to racial discrimination, are actually dealt with. And so, you know, I think what we see last night with the debate really pivoting to bold progressive policies means that Iowans are open to this factor. And then let's remember that, you know, Iowa's 19 days away, but Super Tuesday is not far behind. And as we open up to states like California and Texas and Alabama, it's a much different ballgame. The Iowa caucus alone does not make a primary winner.
Let me share some listener comments. Bill in the San Gabriel Valley writes on the AirTalk page, "I think the problem," putting in quotation marks, "of having an all-white debate field is overblown. There were non-white candidates in the field. Harris, Booker, Yang, they didn't get enough support to qualify. You can't blame the white candidates for that. It's either a problem with the rules for debate eligibility or the party itself for not supporting a non-white candidate." Radon writes on the page, "Like Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren's apparent lack of integrity has been most disappointing. I guess that's why we need a debate cycle for people's true character to come out." Linda writes on the page, "Elizabeth Warren lied about Bernie. She has a history of lies and misrepresentations, but this time she hurt herself badly and proved she's not to be trusted." That's Linda writing on the AirTalk page. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page at kpecc.org. My thanks to Tory Gavito, president of Way to Win. Coming up, we'll talk with LAPD Chief Michael Moore, fresh off of a news conference talking about the latest in crime statistics. Generally, more good news for Los Angeles compared to historic crime rates. We'll also talk about the difficulty in hit-and-run vehicle collisions that have plagued Los Angeles for many years now. Those and more topics coming up. We'll be back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. In case you just tuned in, the House of Representatives voted to send two articles of impeachment to the U.S. Senate, where a trial of President Trump is expected to start Tuesday, the day after MLK Day. We'll have continuing coverage from NPR, Even the BBC coming up this afternoon right here on 89.3 KPCC. We're very pleased to have LAPD Chief Michael Moore with us for his regularly scheduled visit on Air Talk. Chief, welcome back.
Good morning, Larry.
You're fresh off a news conference with Mayor Garcetti where you talked about a number of issues involving crime. Let's talk about some of the top line statistics, homicide, overall crime rates in the City of Angels. What are we seeing?
Well, 2019 was the second year in a row in which our efforts of improving the community safety across Los Angeles saw true results. 7% reduction in overall crime, in that we saw a record low in the sense of our number of homicides. With 253 homicides, that's 7 fewer homicides than the year before. You have to go back to 1962 to get a per capita equivalent. 1966 for a physical number of that few homicides. It's the last 10 years, we continue to be below 300 homicides.
I seem to remember back late 80s, early 90s, we would have this many homicides in what, a couple months or something? It was, I mean, that when the gang activity was at its peak.
In the darkest days of Los Angeles, our homicide totals approached 1,100 and thousands of shooting victims. This last year, through a lot of hard work and engagement with our gang reduction youth development, with our communities, with a focus by our personnel of more men and women in the streets, as well as a focus on gun violence, we saw the lowest number of shooting victims in Los Angeles in more than 22 years.
And to what do you attribute the decrease in violent gang activity? Is some of this the gentrification of Los Angeles and cost of living generally, that fewer gang members live here? How much of it is policing, and how much of it is other factors?
Well, I think it's a shared success story. The investment by this city under then Mayor Villaraigosa and followed and deepened by now Mayor Garcetti in our gang reduction youth development initiatives, both in the prevention and intervention of gang violence, is what I believe is truly improving this. And there is always a role and an impact of enforcement. The reality of gang violence is while we've seen year after year reductions of it, is it still plagues the city with too many homicides. More than 50% of our homicides are still gang related, and nearly 70% of our shootings, while at all time lows, are still gang related. But the efforts of incrementally getting gang intervention workers in the field to reach out and engage and be proactive in stopping the back and forth and the retribution and retaliation that can occur with one incident of violence, I think is making a true impact on this. Their ability to work in the field and also our ability to facilitate and work in concert with them. We're not partners in this engagement, the gang reduction. Those interventions workers, those prevention workers, they have their own details and works, but our coordination with them so that when there is shooting violence, we're working to alert them so that they can go reach out to those families, go out to reach out to associates of those victims and try to quell further violence. I believe that's where we're seeing great strides. I also believe that the work with Summer Night Lights, the programs of 32 parks where we open up those parks during the evening hours so families and communities can enjoy those open spaces and build and reinforce the sense of safety, that those things matter. Jobs programs, giving youth, you know, there's a saying that nothing stops a bullet like a job, giving youth that many of them are at the age of being at risk, giving them opportunities with jobs and other activities can pull them away from a gang lifestyle.
At the peak of gang activity in Los Angeles, one of the things that I think concerns so many Angelenos is the pressure on kids in certain neighborhoods was so extreme to be part of a gang for personal protection, if nothing else, that the numbers of gangs swelled just because kids...
Yes.
To not be in a gang was to put oneself at great personal risk. Has that changed? Are there areas where gangs are still active? Is it easier for kids to not feel they have to join a gang?
I think it's easier today, but it's not easy enough. And what I mean by that is that the efforts of this collective effort of shared opportunities where we have safe passages for children to get to and from school, that we work with our educators so that this conduct of schools, playgrounds, and so forth are not breeding grounds, are not allowed to reinforce a culture of an existence of a gang, so that the level of intimidation to a young person is lowered. There is still intimidation. There are still instances in which young people feel that they don't have a choice. What we're trying to do is work with our gang officers, with our uniform officers, that when they come across young people who are at risk, who are being recruited, who are being drawn into the lifestyle, that we're giving referrals now to social service agencies and resources that can make the intervention, that can come into that area and reinforce that there are activities and there is a resilience that can be built so that child can resist the bullying and the pressure to join into the gang lifestyle.
Historically in Los Angeles, gangs made money in the drug trade. Is that still the principal means of support for those that are deeply committed gang members, or are there other things that are going on economically?
It remains a primary source. We still have organized gangs that are deeply involved in the narcotic trade, whether it be the opioid epidemic or it be cannabis or methamphetamines, cocaine. We also see, though, gangs that have moved into committing home burglaries and committing street robberies and committing actually robberies and attacks on cannabis locations as a means of garnering finances, of their building their wealth, if you will. We see to a lesser degree, but there has been some efforts by them to get into financial crimes. But primarily, their primary modes of raising money for the gang enterprise remain the narcotic trade, as well as conducting or prowling in neighborhoods and committing burglaries and other assaults.
Now, speaking of financial crimes, you're talking about things like identity theft?
Yes.
Okay. And when it comes to burglaries, one of the things we hear is about, the rental of upscale cars that fit into certain neighborhoods, that there are certain practices that are proving effective in conducting home burglaries. What are the ways LAPD officers and detectives are trying to counter those methods?
Well, there's a number of ways, and I'm proud to say that residential burglaries this year are down in Los Angeles. In addition to every property crime category in Los Angeles has seen a reduction. We have a 7.4% reduction in property crime. That is 7,493 fewer property crimes, many of those burglaries, auto thefts, breaking into vehicles. Those crimes were being successful in deterring, first and foremost, by good prevention. Our work with community members hardening the target, improving their resiliency, using these security systems that are available today to alert them that there are people prowling in their neighborhoods, door knocking, looking to see if anyone's home, communicating with each other that these individuals are prowling in these neighborhoods so that neighborhoods can call the police and notify us. As far as the law enforcement side, I'm proud of the work of our Commercial Crimes Division supporting our individual areas to identify rings of individuals, if you will, crews that either exist in Los Angeles or travel to Los Angeles to prey upon these neighborhoods.
We recently did a segment on the Bay Area gang members coming down to the tourist spots here to break into rental cars.
Absolutely. And that's where our investigative efforts of relying upon good tips and leads of information from our communities allow us to conduct those investigations that identify those serial actors. And once those people are identified, I'm very proud of the men and women who go out and capture our fugitive units and our local detectives and, most recently, our metropolitan divisions, which I've retasked towards these investigative follow-ups and these key activities that go and identify these habitual and heavily involved suspects. Bringing them off the street, I think, is partly responsible as well for our success.
We're talking with LAPD Chief Michael Moore. If you have questions for him during his guesting with us here on Air Talk, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Want to turn to traffic fatalities and injuries, collisions between vehicles, cars and pedestrians, cyclists as well. Where do we stand there? Because we've certainly seen significant increase in car versus walker injuries and fatalities.
So it's a mixed bag. And this morning's reports, I tried to point out what we need to work on most. Traffic collisions overall in the city are actually down this year versus last, and the number of fatalities for the third year in a row were reduced from our high number of fatalities that we saw in 2016. However, where we're seeing pressure and where we're most troubled is in our hit and runs involving serious injury or death. And over the course of time, the last 4 to 5 years, we've seen an increase in fatalities involving hit and runs and involving pedestrians. The largest increase we've seen has been in South Los Angeles. And my point this morning was to draw out attention to this matter that we believe that many instances these collisions are accidents that then the motorist is scared or makes an impulsive decision or otherwise and flees and turns it into a very serious crime. The challenge that we have is those individuals then have to live with that. And what I'm encouraging them and others who have information about these type of collisions is to step forward and give the law enforcement an opportunity, to give LAPD a chance to bring some closure to these families. Even an individual who makes the wrong decision to flee from such a scene, they may have been texting, they may have been distracted, they may have even been intoxicated. Trying to live the rest of their life without owning up and stepping forward is I would not wish on anyone. Them stepping forward and identifying themselves not only gives that family closure, but the criminal justice system also understands that people make mistakes, and it will work through that. Not to say there won't be punishment and there won't be a retribution by society, so to speak, but with this incident today, we need to, as a country or as a city, we need to recognize that our greatest incident is pay attention to the road that we're on. When we're walking, pay attention to where we're walking and recognize that if an accident occurs, stop and render aid. Give people help and don't flee the scene.
There are rare circumstances, of course, where people may be concerned for their personal safety if a crowd gathers. And we've had incidents where people who have struck someone have been attacked by crowd, things like that. But, you know, you can drive to a local police station.
Oh, absolutely.
You can do other things to protect your safety from a crowd and turn yourself in.
Absolutely. The reality is this is an accident. Many of those hit and runs that occur are actually a pedestrian in a roadway in a darkened street outside of a crosswalk. The pedestrian may actually be at fault. In those instances, again, the impulse of the person to flee is only compounding the problem, and it's really unnecessary. But even when the motorist is at fault, maybe they're distracted or intoxicated, the key here is to take the responsibility for the actions that this consequence has come from.
When driver's licenses were approved by the state of California for undocumented residents, one of the big selling points was it would reduce the number of hit and run incidents because drivers who were in the country illegally and didn't have a license wouldn't feel the risk of staying on the scene of the collision or incident with which they were involved. Has it had that effect?
Well, actually, overall, there's 3,300 fewer hit-and-run accidents this year versus last. What we're bringing focus to is the instances in which a fatality, a very serious injury, results from a hit-and-run, which is about 1% of all hit-and-runs. The vast majority of hit-and-runs are fender benders or a broken rearview mirror or something. I do believe that the issuance of more than 1 million of these provincial licenses so that people are properly trained, they have insurance, they take the responsibilities of operating a vehicle lawfully on the road has improved traffic safety, and I'm a full supporter of it.
We're talking with LAPD Chief Michael Moore. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Coming up, we're going to be talking with him about officer-involved shootings and what we see there in the number of incidents for 2019. Also, how body cam footage is being handled with officers of LAPD. Also, the investigation into more than 20 LAPD officers with the Elite Metro Division under allegations that field interview cards were falsified to show that members of the public were involved in gang activity or were armed when they in fact weren't. We'll talk about the status of that as well. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, back in just 2 minutes. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Larry Mantle with LAPD Chief Michael Moore, one of his regularly scheduled visits with us. We're going to be talking about the investigation into over 20 LAPD officers who were part of the Elite Metro Division under investigation for allegedly falsifying field interview cards and listing people who were stopped as gang members who weren't. I mentioned incorrectly about allegations people were armed who weren't. That apparently is not part of the investigation. But Chief Moore, One of the things in reading the LA Times coverage of this were concerns that there's a lot of pressure being put on members of Metro to identify gang members, to find illegal weapons that are being held by people that they stop, and that the pressure that's put on them, not to excuse falsifying of data and falsely labeling members of the public, but that that pressure could be a contributor. You accept that?
Well, I don't have those accounts yet. So I read the same media account. This is an investigation that's very much ongoing. And it's one of the areas that I will look to, as I described this morning at our earlier press event. I want to understand what happened. And then I'm also very interested in investigating and determining how it happened so that we can come up with and ensure that it doesn't happen again. And there is absolutely zero tolerance for an officer to falsify a record of any type. An officer's integrity is their most valued and cherished possession. And when they lose that because of a falsification or a cheating, if you will, with the facts, they have absolutely zero worth as a police officer. We must be able to rely upon an officer's word and their testimony, many times even against their own self-interest. So these allegations are very, very troubling. It involves individuals that we have invested a great deal of faith and confidence and training that they are some of our best. Now, we have failures in every organization of every size. In this instance, this matter was brought to us, and we began an immediate investigation. And as that investigation has unfolded, we have expanded it to ensure that we clearly understand the depth and breadth of this. It started with the actions of allegations against three officers. Then we began looking at other officers that worked with those officers, and then another layer of officers who worked with those two groups. We will allow the investigation to take its course. I will not make or pass judgment as to why or how it happened until I have all the information. But I will say in closing to that comment, there are no demands placed on an individual within this organization that we would ever justify lying or falsifying.
No, I understand that there's no justification, but I wonder, are there soft quotas, so to speak? Is there significant pressure that you've got to go out and find gang members?
So in policing for the last two decades, we recognize that cops count, that our work matters. And that means that as we go out and do our work, that we're accountable to what our activities are, how we spend our day, how do we know our tradecraft? Are we engaged in proactively going out and identifying those that are responsible and are engaged in criminal activity? But the measurement of that, which is a necessity and part of understanding how people are performing and whether or not strategies are working, should never drive behavior that would break one ethics. The ends never justify the means. And the concept that someone would game the system by cheating or by implicating someone as a gang member, there is just it's a very immediate response. It's a very strong response. I also believe that the frustration behind this and why we're so blunt on this is that an officer across this agency, 13,000 men and women of this organization, we recognize integrity is our tradecraft. It is our bank in which we build trust in communities. And so when it's threatened or jeopardized by the actions of a few, this is something that we have zero tolerance for. Our investigation will determine what actually has happened here, and we will continue to be transparent to the public as to how that investigation unfolds and what it's found.
Repercussions are huge because this could involve other cases in which officers, if they're guilty of what's alleged here, were involved in investigations, would impair their ability to testify in other cases in which they prosecute, not to mention, perhaps most important, the loss of trust with the communities in which Metro Division's operating.
It is. And so there are people who are saying, well, you know, mistakes happen and an organization your size, you're going to have some bad apples and that's going to happen. That's not my position, is to be apologetic that, you know, these things are going to happen. At this point, our temperament on this is accountability is to determine what occurred and ensure there's consequences appropriately.
I have other listener comments. JSK asks on the page, do serial thieves still end up walking under the Proposition 47 limits?
I believe that the changes that are being made to 47 need to continue. I think that the chronic offender, the individual who repeatedly and in an ongoing fashion commits crimes, particularly property crimes, but even narcotic offenses, that the changes that were made there years ago to keep those or minimize those to a misdemeanor has not resulted in the improvement in community safety or the rehabilitation of those individuals. We need to have, many of these individuals are chronic narcotic offenders and need treatment and are only going to get that treatment if it's supervised by a court and has consequences if they don't go down that path. So the instances of theft this year in Los Angeles, the instances of theft are down. However, I've also heard that retailers and others are discouraged from making reports.
Yeah,
because
what's the point?
They believe that it's not going to go anywhere. So I welcome the state legislature, who I believe we have a number of which are looking at what haircut or trim needs to occur to these significant reforms that occurred years ago. And I look forward to what the authors of Prop 47 and others seek, which is a safer community, but also a system that rehabilitates and gets people back on the right course. I just don't know that we're in that position today. And just as everything is an evolution, some further tightening of this, I think, would be particularly useful.
Rumi in Pasadena says, I've been told LAPD officers have been asked not to ticket RVs that are illegally parked because of people living in them. Is that true?
So there's a recent sunset of a ordinance in Los Angeles, 85.02, that afforded a restriction of no overnight parking in many areas of the city of Los Angeles. And that ended at the end of this last calendar year, 2019. And it's before the council to re-engage, which will allow us to make those citations. I think the challenge that we have right now is that we do have some 8,000 plus individuals living in vehicles without otherwise having shelter. And we need additional safe parking locations. We need additional locations that are designed and can accommodate those vehicles so that there are options other than a neighborhood curb in which there's no facilities for dealing with wastewater and the trash and debris, and the comfort of a neighborhood that is not meant or designed to have these oversized vehicles parked on the roadways.
Speaking of homelessness, we have Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson recently sent a letter to Mayor Garcetti about potential cooperation with the feds, more money that would come from the federal government for homeless services, housing and treatment. But Ben Carson in that letter talked about the need to have more enforcement on the street. And so what, in your view, would that take? What are the impediments your officers deal with now?
Well, so I met with Secretary Carson as well on his visit earlier and expressed what I think many in Los Angeles are looking to, which is a federal government to step into a crisis of our generation at a scale that far exceeds a local area's, a local municipality's ability to deal with. The housing crisis that we have, the lack of mental health resources, the lack of effective interventions on people experiencing chronic drug addiction, those are only a part of the aspect of people being finding themselves on the street because of a health emergency, so they have no safety net, and so they don't have the ability to pay for housing. For those that are finding their way on the street because of an eviction, because of a person converting a rental unit into an Airbnb or some other resource, There is a true crisis. This is not just individuals making decisions that they choose not to live in shelter. So I think that society and as a area, we need to address those matters. For me, as a chief, we are very aware that this population, which has grown, there are elements, small elements, but elements nonetheless, that are criminally involved, preying upon others who are experiencing homelessness or preying upon the neighborhoods in which they are.
I was going to say, many of them are victims of crime, too.
And we treat each individual, regardless of their housing status, with the same dignity of respect, and we will protect victims who are homeless by identifying those responsible. I'm proud of the work of LAPD. The men and women have, with the increase in crimes against people experiencing homelessness, we have seen a commensurate increase in the arrests of those people we believe responsible, many of which are also homeless. So we've not ignored the criminal element here. This last year, we began focusing on the drug trafficking that is occurring within these communities, renewing our focus that an open-air drug market is not going to be allowed in this city. And I look forward in 2020 to continue those initiatives.
Well, and one of the things we've heard in our many conversations with Union Rescue Mission's Reverend Andy Bales is about the kind of extortion that goes on with gang members taking the general relief checks, disability checks of people living on the streets.
We're currently working with our federal partners as well as our gang narcotics and local narcotic resources on just that issue in just that area.
We'll continue our conversation with LAPD Chief Michael Moore. We'll be back on Air Talk in 1 minute. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle with LAPD Chief Michael Moore. Let me share some more listener comments. Mike in Valley Village says, I had part of my car stolen. I took it in guy's shop, said it's so common, not even worth reporting and keeping records on it. So when Chief Moore says car-related thefts are down, is that because they're really down or because people aren't bothering to report it?
Well, we recognize that overall crime is an underreported circumstance. I know that whether it's family violence or property crime or other crimes, people say, well, is it worth the time? I want to just encourage all Angelenos that when they're a victim of a crime to give us the opportunity to understand when and how it happened. It doesn't help to cast a layer of ambiguity where we don't know these crimes are occurring. They may be disappointed that the consequences of an arrest of an individual who broke into that car are not what they believe it should be. But the fact that their car was broken into, that they were victimized, this department stands eager to hear from those victims and to ensure that we can do what we can to identify those responsible and bring them to the justice system.
Jack in Beechwood Canyon says, I'm a recent burglary victim and the police really haven't given my case attention. I've gone to the police station with my partner, but we feel like we're brushed off, like no one really, there's no one to go to. They keep telling us there isn't enough staff to address the case. What's the department doing to deal with that?
Well, we are a finite number of people, and we do prioritize and focus our resources on those crimes that we can have the best opportunities of being solved. A residential burglary that has little or no evidence of who the offender was, there is a limit to what our ability to identify those responsible are. And at times, that's a hard conversation for people to hear. However, if there are ever an instance in Los Angeles in which a victim of a crime believe they understand and know who's responsible for that crime, or that we should reasonably be able to identify that person, and they feel that they're being brushed off, I ask for them to speak with a supervisor. They can speak with an area CO, area commanding officer. They can write a letter to me. They can, we will ensure that what resources we have are prioritized and are assigned to investigations that have that have opportunities to being solved.
I could be wrong, but I think there's a fairly widely held perception that when it comes to property crimes, particularly home burglaries, residential burglaries, that neighboring cities do a better job at actually catching the people responsible, that they have higher clearance rates. Is that an accurate perception or not?
I don't believe it is. I believe that our policing in Los Angeles is at par and above many other agencies and would compare our record to anyone. The reality is that in Los Angeles, we solve thousands of cases, tens of thousands of cases. this is a big city where we don't bring the media into every arrest, and we don't champion every capture. We do try to recognizing there's a limit to the public's attention when we bring media attention to when we are solving crimes, to reinforce the fact that there are consequences, that we will act. But we also don't want to wear that out by every day talking about the arrests that are made of individuals prowling and victimizing people in the community. Lastly, I will say that one of the challenges I see that is helping us, that we're seeing better results on, is a community resiliency of taking their responsibility and a shared responsibility for understanding that they're a victim of a crime and how they can improve, how they can prevent crime in the future. The fact that they would not report the crime adds to our challenge of reducing crime. The fact that they're not reporting it does not mean crime is less. It's just that means the law enforcement's not been given an opportunity to understand it and apply resources to that. The fact that they're a victim of a crime, not sharing that with us, also jeopardizes how do they alert their neighbors and how can we as a neighborhood watch and as a community strengthen our resolve and our resilience against those that are prowling in our neighborhoods.
Wanted to talk about body cams briefly here. Is the department increasing its amount of review of body cam footage of officers to determine whether best practices are being followed and to match officers' reporting and accounts of encounters with the public with what's visible on the video?
Yes, with the onset of adding body-worn video cameras to 7,000 of our personnel, the people who are working in the field in uniform, we have always looked at critical instances such as arrests, uses of force, instances in which someone goes to jail. What we have not done is, in a systematic manner, routinely reviewed encounters between you and me in a traffic encounter, unless there was a complaint. Then, we dug that up. Starting this month, we are now on a randomized basis looking each month, each supervisor involving gang officers and metropolitan officers to look at in interactions that don't result in an arrest or a citation. How was the conduct of the officer? Did the officer treat the person with respect? Was the officer's training followed by his or her actions? Did the officer document that interaction accurately? I believe that what we've done when we've done these snapshots in the past, we find the vast majority of time, well in excess of 90%, 9 out of 10 times, that the officer's actions were appropriate. Seldom we'd find an error that we take corrective action. Now we're going to do that each month systematically about the entire department.
Ralph in Palm Springs asked, does LAPD have school outreach programs? I remember when I was a kid in LA schools, LAPD officers would come talk, just answer questions, talk about what they do to sort of build a sense of understanding. Is that still done?
Yes, it is. We're working with a number of different organizations, including the Constitutional Rights Foundation, where officers working in geographic areas visit local schools, junior high schools, elementary schools. We are not present in every LA Unified School District school around the city. We frankly just do not have the resources. We do partner with LA Unified School District police officers in an effort to build a relationship between youth and officers and reduce the stigma on both sides about the respective roles and responsibilities and actions of each. I'm proud of that youth engagement. We also have expanded our youth programming, our cadet corps, our other youth programs to demystify what police officers do and also provide mentorship capabilities for young people going forward.
I want to just give you a few seconds, and we don't have a lot of time, but to pay tribute to the late Earl Pasinger, a man I know you regarded so highly and was the second highest ranking LAPD executive.
Well, thank you, Larry. Last Tuesday, I had the honor of attending his memorial service, his celebration of life. Miguel, his wife, his sons, Brian and Stephen, were there. And the department had a moment to pay, I believe, a small measure of tribute to a great man who leaves a great legacy of service, of dedication, who himself invested in the youth of this city, and who I believe has set us to on a future of being a safer city and a brighter light on the hill. I miss him. He was a friend, a colleague, He was a giant.
And such a major figure in the African-American community of Los Angeles.
Absolutely. A success.
All right, Chief, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Chief Michael Moore, LAPD. Earl Paysinger passed away at the age of 64, but leaving behind a tremendous legacy in the community and in law enforcement. Have a good afternoon.